Trigger warning on today's episode. We touch on topics of abuse, addiction, suicide, and infidelity. This is fortunately a story that ends with hope and continual healing. I recently had someone say to me that these episodes are not just for women. They're about issues we all face or can be affected by. He was right, but they are through the lens of women struggling to find their good enough. Today, we have a vibrant woman, mother of two young kids, and who by all accounts is just now re-entering the work field with gusto. She once worked as an account manager at a marketing agency at the top of her game, at least on the outside, until she found herself contemplating what it was all worth. Her own life in the balance and her estranged family is seemingly her only place to turn. All right, welcome to the Good Enough Woman podcast. We're here on a dreary morning, but hopefully when the sun's out, it won't be so much. But my guest today is Miss Tamara Young.
Hello.
And hello. We have a really extensive story and emotional kind of journey to take ourselves through today. We could sit here and chit chat because that's what we do.
Sure. Yeah.
But we're going to dive in pretty quickly because I know you have a lot to say. And of course, you're a mom. So you've got to go take the kids to an animal farm later today.
Yeah, no big deal.
Yeah.
We're going to move from talking about our deepest, darkest secrets all the way to farming it up with unicorns.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
Unicorns.
I loved unicorns. Do you love unicorns? I don't know why. I've always loved unicorns.
I've never had a particular affinity for unicorns, but I'm not against unicorns. I love watching my daughters love unicorns.
Yeah. There was a movie when I was younger and it was called The Last Unicorn. I can't tell you how many times I watched that movie.
And do you want to come, Karina?
Spoiler alert, but at the end of the movie, it was always my favorite part, the end of the movie, because these unicorns would get cast to the ocean and they were released from the ocean at the end of the movie. So these waves come crashing and the unicorns come out of the waves. It was so beautiful.
Karine, you want to watch? That's what you're doing with your Saturday after this. You're watching that movie. I can feel it.
I might. I've told my daughter about that movie before. We've never watched it. But anyway.
Anywho.
Unicorns. Speaking of unicorn, you actually, to me, are a bit of unicorn.
Oh my God.
And the reason I say that is because, first of all, people will be able to see you when they hear this or see our clips. But you're beautiful. You're educated, you are articulate, and you are a go-getter.
Thank
and
you.
I love that about you. But I know that has not always been the case.
Mm-hmm.
And let's walk it back a little bit because we've got a lot to unpack and a lot to talk about.
Are you sure? Because you just definitely made me feel good enough. So we could probably be done.
We're done.
I'm smart. Okay. I'm hardworking. I'm pretty. We can just... That's the end of the story, you guys.
Yeah, great. But yeah. How you got here is a really tough one. Tell me about your upbringing and how you got, because there's a middle section that we really want to talk about, and that's some of your turning points. But let's walk ourselves up to those turning points and how you got there.
Yeah, we'll just set the stage, add a little bit of context before we go right to
the hard stuff.
The hard stuff.
Yeah.
That is just heavy on my heart more recently, which is the topic of family estrangement.
Yes.
I don't think it's discussed enough for understandable reasons, but I wish it were more. And my disclaimer is I don't think it's for everyone to share publicly what their experience has been. I understand that there's a particular brand of shame that underscores the whole topic of family estrangement, but I do think it's very misunderstood.
Yeah, and there's a lot of different reasons why.
Yeah, and it can look... I've had various forms of family estrangement over the last several years. And so I am excited, actually, as weird as that sounds, to get into it, because I think I've just noticed the more stories I've heard, I've noticed a lot of women in particular who have experienced that, and the little that I've spoken publicly about it. Because first of all, I wouldn't say anything here publicly that I either haven't said to my parents or I wouldn't say directly to their face. And so I feel perfectly at peace sharing my story. It's mine to share. And I feel like other people do need it. Just the little bits and pieces I've heard from women responding to what I've shared, like, thank you. I can't really talk about this because X, Y, and Z, I'm going through this too. I'm excited to get into that and just share my story openly and describe what that's looked like and what led to the, making those decisions and the whole fun topic of boundaries with family members. But to answer your question, finally, yeah, let's talk about...
Let me stop you for just a second, because that is one of the things that I really love about you. And that has immediately endeared me to you when we met, is that you have a lot, but you are willing to share, because not only does it do work in your own self by sharing it and giving it a voice for you, but you are someone who really wants to help others. And if telling your story does that, then you feel that kind of sense of release. And I really appreciate the fact that you are willing to share with anyone at any time.
Thank you.
Sorry, going back.
Yeah, speaking of sharing, the context for me is, and when I talk about my childhood, I do talk about it like the things that we internalized and experienced, not even just as children, as adults too. It doesn't necessarily mean it's like objective reality. If you're like, oh, I felt like a burden growing up, it doesn't necessarily mean, oh, your parents were trying to make you feel that way.
Sure. You and I could have grown up in the same household, had the same set of rules, had the same parents, had the same everything, responses to things. And my interpretation of it can be different than what your interpretation of it was.
And I have a little brother who's 7 years younger than me, who is, I'm not going to talk about him much because I'll start crying. But he's always been my favorite human on the face of the earth. And that happened with us as adults when we started talking about these things. He, of course, picked up on some of the same things, but he internalized them very differently than I did because of how different our earliest childhood experiences were. And so even in the same household, like sibling relationships, you can have a completely different perspective on your growing up years.
Oh gosh, I remember a time when my brother, it was silly. My parents were teachers. They expected us to have good grades because, not because we had to have good grades, but because they knew that we were capable of it. Mm. And I remember my brother was a freshman in high school. And I think he got, I might make this up, but 2 A's, 2 B's and 2 C's or something like that. And I got 4 A's and 2 B's. And I don't know that he was sat down or not. I don't think he was. I was sat down and talked to, and I was like, wait, he has worse grades than I do. Like, why am I getting the conversation? But at the same time,
more.
There was a lot of other things going on with that. It is just what it is.
Yeah. And speaking of expats, that's a perfect segue, because I'm the oldest daughter. I was the first grandchild on both sides, but I did not come first, at least not, especially for my mom. So my mom, when my parents were dating, her dad, he passed away a couple of years ago, but he was a Pentecostal preacher her whole life. So she grew up in a very humble Pentecostal, like staunchly religious family. And she and my dad, when they met, my dad was 9 years older than her, and they met when she was very young. She got pregnant and they had an abortion. And that really, I think, impacted, and she and I have talked about this, it really impacted the lens through which she was seeing, especially me. So they got married really quickly, and she didn't want the abortion, by the way. She felt like she had no other choice. Her whole world, she felt, would have completely shattered had she not. And so I say that because, looking back, there were very unfair expectations on me. And my mom would say things when I was little, even though I didn't know what it happened. Of course, you don't understand as a child, but she would say things like, "You're God's greatest gift to me." Basically, that I saved her. She would die without me. She doesn't know what she would do without me. And so I really feel, looking back, like there, I felt that way even as a child, that I had better be worth.
You better be perfect.
I better be worth the decision that she made. Because timing-wise, I came right after my parents got married. Timing-wise, I certainly wouldn't have been born when I was, had she had gone through with that pregnancy. There was a bit of a dark cloud hanging over my mom. And my mom has, spoiler alert, a story very similar to mine of her upbringing. This is a story about really everything I've done since becoming a mom has been about, no more, it stops here with passing on these mother-daughter dynamics, particularly with the oldest daughter in our families. That's the common theme. But I entered the world. My parents did not have the greatest relationship. They were both just really young, really sick people. And there was a lot of violence. So I remember being like like a really happy-go-lucky, like fun baby. I was very doted on in the family. And at the same time, I witnessed a lot of things that children, of course, should never have to witness. My mom took me to live in a women's shelter for a time when I was two, just to escape the violence. I mean, I remember my dad holding down my mom with a knife at one point, threatening to kill her. And the way I remember it as a child is like, oddly enough, that I was doing something wrong by walking in on that. Of course, that I was somewhere I wasn't supposed to be. And I would walk in. My dad had affairs with me and my babysitters. My mom worked night shifts as a nurse. And I saw just a lot of inappropriate things that little toddlers shouldn't see. But the worst time in my life, as far as like when things really shifted when I was a child, because I really felt still like very precious and loved in my family. I felt like everybody doted on me up until my dad. He was in the Army Reserves and he was called to active duty in the Gulf War. And when he left and it was just me and my mom, it was the worst time in my childhood, hands down, because I started to endure just constant beatings. I just remember a lot of tension in my house. Like when my mom was up, she was really up and I had to figure out how to match her up energy and be happy and funny and entertaining enough to like be at her level. And then when she was low, I just walked around on eggshells because I knew it was coming and it would be for the most benign reasons that I could never guess or I couldn't honestly help as a child, but thought I should be able to help. Like I started wetting the bed during that time. I started having night terrors during that time and I would get punished for those things. And so, and when I say beating, we had dowel rods, these wooden sticks. She would use belts. She would use her hands. She would choke. I would wake up to being choked out. I don't remember the physical pain, but I remember the look of hatred on her face most. I remember being convinced. I would ping pong around from being like, my mom hates me. My mom hates me. There's something wrong with me. All the way to the beatings would end with her usually like me laying out on my bed on my stomach at night, and she would put ice packs all over my backside and she would just be sobbing just from the incredible guilt and regret. And she would promise, I promise I will never do this again. I love you so much. You're God's greatest gift to me.
The dichotomy between being beaten and not feeling like you're worth anything to her to being the most precious thing to her.
Yes.
As a child. And what age were you around then?
I was about 4 to 5. It was around, 4 turning 5. And being in a position to comfort your mother after you've endured that, because that's what I would do. She would, you were God's way of forgiving me. And here she is sobbing. And I wasn't allowed to sob.
She needed your forgiveness at that point.
Yes, she needed my forgiveness. I couldn't cry. And then I did, but I would get punished harder for crying. I would literally get beaten while she had me look in the mirror, telling me that she would keep hitting me until I smiled in the mirror and had a good attitude. So that only makes me emotional because it's impossible. My daughters are 2 and 3 years old. Mm-hmm. So it's impossible not
to think about
to
them.
Imagine that and to imagine how my mom, that must have killed my mom to live with that guilt over and over again. But yeah, being in a position to comfort her, and it really warped my idea of love because it was so tied up in pain. That
how could you look for something else?
That's yes. And I really believed.
And you loved your mom.
I loved her so much. And I really believed every time that those bouts would end, I really believed, oh, she's not going to do this again. And oh, she really loves me. So I would go from my mom hates me to, oh, I'm God's greatest gift to her. She loves me so much. So that's what happened during that time when I recognized my mom must have felt very alone during that time. She was also, I didn't know this at the time, but I learned later in life, she was contemplating divorcing my dad. So she had bought a house that we moved into while he was away and was trying to decide when he comes back, do I just serve him divorce papers? And this is just our house now. But for whatever reason, my dad came back, my parents stayed together. My mom got pregnant right away with my little brother. And so he was born when I was
5. Have to tell you, I love our website and I couldn't have done it without the help of Burrow Business Lab. If you haven't seen it yet, our logo spins and the images dance off the page. It's so exciting. Now I can get back to the business of bringing you all the good enough women you can listen to because they have my back. If you have any website, SEO, or social media needs, reach out to Burrow Business Lab today.
No, he was born when I was six. I was in first grade. And it was, I remember that. So like, I remember being called out of my first grade class. I remember the button. I still have the button that they gave me at the hospital that said, I'm a big sis. I thought he was my baby, like full on.
Yeah.
I was like, this is my child now. I guess I'm
a mom. Did your mom say that to you just to make you feel?
Yeah. Like they were great about making me feel included in it. Yeah. I wanted to do anything that a six-year-old could be responsible for or try to pretend like she was responsible for. Right. I tried to do, because I was like, I'm going to take care of him. And part of it is I love my brother so much and I really wanted a sibling.
You were also helping your mom.
Yes. And a big part of it was like my life got so much better. Like things got so much better during that time. And so I think I projected that onto my brother and I was like, oh, it's my brother's arrival. My brother like saved my life here.
Right.
And because things just got better. And I think probably it was a combination of my mom wasn't alone in it anymore. She had help now. My parents were never... that I remember, they would have some fights, but I don't remember any violence in our household after that point, really at all. We still got spanked. The fear never left me. So I was constantly, and it's something my brother and I talked about later, because he was like, I got spanked too. And I was like, yeah, but I got to tell you about what happened before you were born, because I think that's what hardwired this constant treading on thin ice for me.
That fight or flight was just deep inside you.
Oh, yeah. I was so sensitive. And my mom still had major mood swings. She would come in. I felt like she really relished. And my mom, I can't diagnose her as a narcissist. That's never happened. But she certainly has shown throughout my entire life some narcissistic traits. And I feel like she really relished. And one of the ways she controlled me was constantly keeping me on my toes. So she would do things like, just to me, not my brother, she would announce one night, sit me down and say, oh, your dad and I are getting a divorce. And she would map the whole thing out, Green. She would say, here's where you're going to live and how we're going to do it. We've already planned everything out. And then the next morning, sit me down at breakfast and be like, we decided not to get a divorce. We decided we're going to stay together. And she would take me on this emotional roller coaster constantly. She would announce, oh, we're actually going to pull you out of school. And I loved school, by the way. It was my safe place. I was obsessed with like academics and sports and any like activity I could get my hands on, I wanted to do. I would get flack for it at home because my mom was like, you never want to be at home with your family like you should. And I felt shame for that, but it was also the truth. I was like, I don't ever want to be at home. What is wrong with me? Everybody else likes spending time with their family. I cannot stand it. Like I dread
school too, though.
Yeah, I just loved it. And so she would, we're going to pull you out of school and we're going to travel the country in an RV, just the four of us, and we're going to homeschool you. And then that plan would never come to fruition. And she would make me late. That was some of the times I remember being the angriest, because I was never allowed to express my anger, right? So she would make me late to activities or practices that I really wanted to go to. And because she had to drive me. And I remember I would sit in the back of our van with like my fists balled up, because I couldn't say anything, because she was doing it on purpose. And it was like, the more I expressed any sort of discomfort, same was true of physical affection. If she was like touching me or tickling me and I just didn't want her hands on me, I had to just freeze and take it and not show any sign of discomfort, because it was like, it felt like she relished in it and mm-hmm. she would do it more. The more I can't express anger or frustration over being late, or she's going to make me even later, or I may not even be able to go at all. So it was just a constant stuffing of my feelings, always expected to smile. The thing I got spanked for the most was having a bad attitude, quote unquote, which in my household was code for showing anything other than being the happy, go lucky, good girl. So to this day, I always have a smile plastered. Most of the time it's genuine, but I catch myself still when I'm like talking about something traumatic and I like laugh, because it's just so deeply ingrained in me to just smile through everything, smile through the most painful moments.
That's a very natural thing. I've listened to a psychologist talk about that many times about why did you just laugh there? Talking to him on podcasts and things like that. But because it's the natural defense mechanism to cover up what it is that you don't really want to touch at that moment. And you're just going to, it's this nervous, but yet I'm going to move on.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier to do than to sit and have to tell somebody like this. That's a lot. Let me tell you why I feel this way. You got 25 hours. It's easier sometimes to laugh it off until you feel like you're in a safe space.
Exactly. Yeah. I guess the last thing in my childhood, I want to say the way I really remember my entire childhood from birth until I moved out or escaped, as I like to say, escaped to another prison. I always felt bad. I just felt like a really bad girl. I grew up, of course, in purity culture, a lot of religious ideology. And I remember thinking, I actually looking back, I'll hear stories about people rebelling and what that looked like for them and how they would sneak out of the house or drink or go to a party. I didn't have my first drink until my 21st birthday, Kareen. I was so good, but I followed all of the rules I was given, stayed pure for marriage, all of the things, memorized my Bible verses, performed in school, performed in church. I was just such a performer for everyone. I did all the right things and still somehow felt like I was really bad inside because I felt like all of my desires, all of the things that I wanted, whether it was nice things or an education, career, whatever I wanted, a boy, God forbid, that those desires were just inherently bad.
Because you were feeling like you had to seek outside acknowledgement or outside attention to make you feel or at least replace what you weren't getting at home. But that's where you really wanted it.
Yeah. And then I felt guilty for it. Yeah, exactly. And then when I was 11 or 12, I learned, so I'd been really close to my aunt, my mom's baby sister. She's only 7 years older than me. And so she was around since I was a baby. She babysat me when I was little. My mom worked nights. She would stay overnight with me and my dad. She took care of me a lot. I idolized her growing up. I thought she was just the coolest. She seemed so free. And she was going to college and she had friends and she could drive anywhere she wanted. And she worked as a pizza delivery person, which was so cool. And she's vegetarian, which I tried for 2 seconds. And I was like, I'm going to have chicken nuggets now. But but I announced to all my friends I was vegetarian, like my favorite aunt. And I learned when I was 11 or 12, here's how it was put to me. My mom sat me down and she was like, I need to tell you about something that's happened in our family. Because she would always say when she and my dad got in fights and I felt like it was unfair to my dad, I always felt very defensive of my dad because he was my protector, right? He intervened. I really had a soft spot for my dad. He was always just there. I felt bad for him because I was like, man.
If you were enduring this, what was he enduring?
Yes. And he was taking the brunt of my mom's moods in arguments where he was clearly in the right and she had no leg to stand on, but I still had to take her side because that was my job. I just felt really bad for him and defensive of him. And she would say things like, you don't know what your dad has done. And so she would drop those little hints constantly to me when they were fighting. But she sat me down and she said, something happened and I want you to hear about it from me so that you don't hear about it from somebody else. And she said, your dad and your aunt had an affair. And I was really young and I just thought, oh, that's bad. That involves something like to do with sexual sin and that's bad. But I was like, oh, I forgive him. I forgive my dad, of course, because I knew my role was to forgive. And it took me several years to really pick up bits and pieces because all I knew was they chose to do something together. I'm not sure what, but something inappropriate together. And now my aunt, who is now like 18 or 19 years old, refuses to be around my dad, is super mad at him, is like threatening to expose him. And it's all her fault. I hate her because I really blamed her because everybody else in the family did. She was, by the way, an easy target. She was easily the scapegoat because she's living in sin as a lesbian, which is like the unpardonable sin of my family. And she's angry and resentful and bitter for no reason. Like, I just didn't understand it.
Yeah, she's the one that came in and messed up my family.
Yes, and that she's threatening too. She's making my parents unhappy because they're constantly worried about her ruining his reputation. And I just didn't understand, but I started to learn over the years that what really took place is my dad sexually abused my aunt from the time she was about 7 until the time she was about 12 or 13. And that was a mind fuck because here I am with my dad, who I've always viewed as my protector, the one who shields me from my mom and takes some of the brunt of that and her anger, and who is just this boisterous, everybody loves my dad. He's the entertainer. He's so funny. He's just easy to be around. And I never get in trouble with my dad. And
yeah, he's not causing you pain.
How do you reconcile as a teenage girl that the same man who's your protector is also a pedophile? And I didn't really, it took me years to process this screen because even then I didn't trust the bits and pieces that I was getting because I'm no longer in communication with my aunt. At that time, I ended up reconnecting with her much later in life, but that added just another whole layer to our family drama and dynamics because it would pop up over the years. I felt stupid because I couldn't piece together why at the time. My parents called me at one point when I was in my early 20s and they were like, oh, we're all stressed because your aunt is threatening again to blah, blah, blah. And I was like, why is she threatening? Oh, it's because my dad switched careers and now he's a school teacher. That's why. So they were constantly trying to cover their tracks. And oh, that's why they moved away to the other side of the state so that she hopefully wouldn't find out these things that he's putting himself in positions to work with kids. So I'll jump back to that at some point. But really what I've recognized, and I'll tell you about what happened with me, because I obviously have a story of over mm-hmm. the course of adulthood becoming hopelessly addicted to alcohol. It started off slow and then accelerated very quickly in my late 20s, early 30s when I moved to Nashville. I'm talking a handle of vodka, a day drinker, the hopeless kind where I ended up losing everything, trying to kill myself, really convinced that I would never be able to get sober. And I was either going to have to just drink myself to death or try to make an easy escape. That's what I thought. But before that, like looking back, the reality is I've been estranged from my family my entire adult life, ever since I moved out. I just didn't recognize it. Nobody called it estrangement early on because we were still...
You just knew you wanted to get away.
Yes. And we still had that illusion of the happy family where we still had those obligatory phone catch-ups. We would see each other once or twice a year at family gatherings or holidays or something. For a while, it seemed to actually get better. And I'll tell you the irony. It was bonding over alcohol because that was a big sin growing up. I never grew up around alcohol, even though alcoholism I knew ran in my family as far as to the extent that it is genetic, whatever, or is trauma genetic, I don't know. But I knew that I had some relatives from past generations who had died of alcoholism and it really impacted them. And so all I knew was like, stay away from it because it's bad. And then I had my first experience getting drunk and I was like, they lied. This is the best. Like, I felt like I could breathe for the first time in my life. I could just take a deep breath and be myself and nobody gave a shit.
But partly because all of the pain and everything that you were carrying was silenced for a minute.
Oh, it just evaporates for a second. But that breathe, when you live your entire life unconsciously, of course, in fight or flight, and then you get a moment of release, of course, your life is going to be about chasing that over and over again. So it really, I like to say alcohol really actually worked for me really well until, of course, it didn't. And so when my parents would start visiting, I was in my mid-20s-ish, and they would visit and we'd all be together as a family again. My parents, I thought it was a huge step for them, actually. My parents would like actually partake a little bit because I think they were really trying. And I thought, okay, this is like, they do love, and even if they don't actually accept me, they love me enough to pretend that they do and to do this. So that went a long way. I just thought,
yeah, we're bonding in a different way.
We're bonding.
And we don't have to talk about all this stuff in our past. We can just sit around and have a good time and laugh.
And I can get hammered and get through this time with my family. And my little brother and I would go off to my closet and take shots together. And it felt okay for a while. And it didn't sting as much when I would hear women talking about going to brunch with their mom or going shopping or having their mom help with their first baby. Because I always felt like such an alien when I heard those things. Because I was like, I should want that. I'm just a terrible daughter. I'm terrible. I'm unlovable. I'm not worth my parents making that effort with me like other parents do. And no wonder they don't, because I don't make an effort. There's something like broken in me. I clearly don't value family the way that I should. That's what I thought, is that I just didn't like morally like value family enough. And so I was really really distant, especially the more my addiction worsened, the more I kept them away.
And was that keeping them away to hide the addiction, keeping them away to hide the pain, or a little bit of both, probably?
A little bit of both, but really it wasn't even about hiding. It was hiding because I didn't trust them at all. So it was we could be happy-go-lucky and have a few drinks and play card games at a holiday party. That was one thing, because then they'd leave. But letting them in on any part of my life that was actually real and intimate, no, thank you. I'm not going to do that.
You don't want their judgment.
I don't want their judgment. I don't want their input. I think I always felt like I need to protect myself from reinserting themselves into my life.
Sure. You didn't want what they had. Therefore, you didn't want to have anything. You didn't want them to tell you anything about what they thought.
And then I had that decision, had to make a 180 on that after my suicide attempt. Because, so I was in Nashville and I had gotten really drunk and tried to kill myself. And the next morning when I woke up in the hospital, my parents were there and they had driven from El Dorado. And I was on a different planet, mind you, withdrawing from alcohol on top of just this really abrupt.
What did I do?
Yes.
Where am I?
Immediately regretted it because I didn't want to die. I really didn't want to die. I had gotten so drunk that I was like, I got to leverage this liquid courage and just get myself out so that it's over. But I really didn't want to die. I had gotten drunk enough where I didn't see another way out. I ended up being diagnosed. I've never heard this before, but in the hospital, they were like, you have alcohol-induced depression. Oh, okay. But my parents were there. I had just been through a breakup with the person I moved to Nashville with a few months prior. Really great guy. But he saw all of the worst of the addiction, the self-harm, all of that just accelerate. I was addicted to Adderall too. So the combination was just deadly. And when my parents got to the hospital, it was just really jarring because, of course, it's not like I didn't even want them there because they were really, who else is going to be there?
Right. You're not going to call this ex-boyfriend.
And so they got there and immediately my mom she was sobbing and she was telling me how painful this was for her. And within 10 minutes of being there was telling me, oh, and I tried to call your ex, let's just call him Joe because I don't want to say his name, but I tried to call Joe and I tried to text Joe and she just looked at me with this pity and she said, and he didn't respond. And I don't want to have to tell you this, but I think you need to know he just doesn't care about you.
Thanks,
so I'm waking up in a hospital bed already so humiliated and not, and my ex was nowhere on my mind. Like, why did you call him? Why did you text him? But already they've inserted themselves into that position. And within 10 minutes, it's about how sad my mom is and how my ex doesn't care if I lived or died. And he showed up at the hospital, by the way, like a couple hours later because he had gotten the messages. And he was actually a godsend.
And really did care if you were okay.
He really did care. He sat with me for a little bit and he ended up being the one to drive me home from the mental hospital because I was now in custody of the state of Tennessee, basically. And once you're in that system, they couldn't bring plastic forks into my room. They took out all my jewelry. I was in the hospital for about a week. And then I was transferred to my mandatory stay at a mental health care facility. And part of that process, because I'm such an expert now, is that you have to have support on the outside. You have to have someone to vouch for. Yes, they're telling the truth that they have a place to live, that they have something to come back to, that they have a safe situation. You have to have somebody. And so a lot of times when people get stuck in those institutions, it's not because they couldn't transition back into the real world. It's sometimes because they don't have any support. And so who was going to be that? The plan was for it to be my parents. And I went in and there's a mandatory 3-day hold. And then after that, it's at the discretion of your clinical team. Because their job is really, I'm sorry, but you're not getting any help in a mental institution. You're just not. Their job is to make sure you don't hurt yourself or anybody else. Make sure you're not a threat to yourself or to others. And then you got to go and you got to get help. And so that was the plan, is for me to go find a rehab, find my very first rehab. And I'm talking with my parents. They're on the phone. I'm filling them in, which is a big step for me. I'm telling them this is what the treatment team is saying. This is the plan. So I was like, I'm being a good daughter. I'm actually letting them in. They've seen me at my worst and I'm including them.
And this is what their job is. They're supposed to help me get back on my feet.
Yes. And then I find out that the day before I'm supposed to leave, so it was the second of the third day, my caseworker and psychologist call me in to the office and they say, hey, don't panic. because they, by the way, you're like on meds the whole time you're there because I was withdrawing from alcohol still. And it's probably the worst part of withdrawing is the anxiety, like the intense, like feeling like you're crawling out of your skin. And you're in a mental institution.
Yeah, you have nothing. You can no longer numb the pain.
It's so scary.
Or quiet the voices. They're there.
Yes.
And they're loud.
And you're watching people having full-on hallucinations. It's people who are really, you're surrounded by people who really need help. Like people who are borderline catatonic. People are having these outbursts and trying to attack nurses. It was real. I was in a state-run mental institution, Kareem. But the doctor and the caseworker call me in and they're like, don't panic. Stay calm, but we want to tell you what's been going on. Your parents called. And I was just like, oh. And your parents called and they want you to stay for a long time. They want us to keep you here. They were trying to tell our clinical team, override our clinical advice and say that you need to stay and that because they can't come pick you up. They've gone back to their lives in El Dorado and they're not going to be able to get back up here to take you home and that you're really sick and they need to stay, that you need to stay. And we told them, don't worry. We told them that's not going to happen. That's not how this works. She needs to go actually get some help for her alcohol addiction. That's what's going on here. Do you have somebody else you can call? You mentioned that your ex is supportive and that he could potentially pick you up and drive you. Could we talk to him? And so, of course, Joe agreed and was gracious enough to talk with them and happy to pick me up and drive me home. But I called my parents right after that and I was like, listen, I'm here trying to include you and you're lying to my face while you're telling my clinical team. I was like, what are you trying to do here?
Did you not think I was going to hear about it?
I just had such a sense of complete panic rush over my entire body because all I heard was they are trying to control me again. They want to be like, this is what I spent my whole life trying to escape, is their control. I would trust a person off the street, Kareem, and I'm not exaggerating here. I would have trusted a person off the street, a random person to make decisions on my behalf more than I trusted my parents. That's how little I trusted them. And it just felt like a betrayal. And honestly, because I had accidentally seen some of their text messages with some of their church friends when I was in the hospital about them exaggerating my situation and all of that. And I was a prayer request now. And honestly, if I'm being totally real, the thought that was going through my head is, oh, the longer I stay in, the more of a sick daughter story they have.
Yeah, the more attention they get.
The more attention they get
for having you in this situation.
Finally escaped that. And I feel like my sobriety, recovery, relapse, all of that story is for another episode, unless there's anything specific you want to know. But long story short, it took me 2 years to finally get sober. And over the course of those 2 years, at one point, like that first rehab I went to, I'll back up. I went to rehab after that. I drove myself. I stayed sober, by the way, after that mental hospital. And I drove myself to Missouri to check into a rehab facility I would never recommend to anybody, but it was newer. And I checked myself in. And when I did my intake and the therapist asked the last question, she said, and do you have any trauma? I was like, what do you mean by trauma? And she listed off a few examples. I don't remember what, but I was like, oh no, I don't have any trauma. And I remember that so vividly because I remember doing the quick math and I was like, there were some awful things, but I don't think that qualifies. And it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
It was in the past. And
I've gotten over them.
And yeah,
so that's not trauma.
I kept going.
Yeah.
Like I went to college. I had a successful career in marketing and advertising. I just completely naive thinking.
Well, because you're thinking trauma is like a very specific one-time thing, car accident or as a death in your family.
That you haven't gotten over.
Literally pinpoint, but that's not necessarily the case.
Obviously. And so I said no. And then over the course of the next, maybe a year later is when I finally was introduced to the concept. And I started just eating up all I could and going down the rabbit hole because it was like the floodgates open and I was like, oh, I have so much that I haven't healed.
Now you want to talk about trauma? Here we go. Here's my buffet.
Yes. And so I went to a trauma treatment center and just got the whole buffet of psychoeducation, learning some embodiment practices and some tools. I wrote letters that I never sent, did a lot of journaling exercises, talked a lot about it in individual therapy and group therapy. I did all the therapy, Green. I had my like a lifetime's worth of therapy. And because my perspective is, okay, I have trauma. Let's tackle it. Let's fix it.
Yeah.
You know, let's fix it so I can get sober.
Yeah. Let's address it and it'll be done.
And it'll be done. And as we know, there's healing is like a spiral. It's not like this linear progression. And today I have a very different perspective than I had then, which today I'm like, oh, it's none of this is about assigning blame. All of this is about taking responsibility. Like it is my responsibility and mine alone to decide how I'm going to heal myself and live my life and mother my girls and be involved in interpersonal relationships. It's my responsibility how I show up in the world. And all of my past experiences, the ones that were no fault of mine and the ones that I created, those are all my responsibility to forgive, to heal, to move on.
True, but where do you... I think the hardest thing for you in that, or for anyone, for any of us, is if you weren't taught it. I mean, I was lucky enough to have a great relationship with my mom and a good relationship with my dad a little bit later. But that if you don't know, if you don't learn it, how do you know what you're, how do you know how to show up and how to take that responsibility or that you're doing the right thing, that you're, that's very difficult.
It's very difficult.
And then if you have nobody to even ask to say, okay, I know that this wasn't right, but now I want to do these things. Where do you turn?
That's so true. I think thankfully we're in a time now that my parents didn't have the luxury of, that it's more talked about. Mm-hmm. There are podcasts like yours, Corrine. But it's talked about more. And so I think there is a lot more, I hate the term awareness, but there is a lot more awareness. There are a lot more tools. But when I say taking responsibility, it's not necessarily, oh, you have to find clinical help and learn all of this on your own, like even moment to moment, like yeah. Recognizing, for example, my youngest daughter is like a ball of anger sometimes. Like she has no trouble expressing her anger. My oldest is a lot like me. She's like people pleaser. And so we'll work on that in a different way. But my youngest one is very, I've come to love that the most about her and respect the hell out of it. I love that about her. And it is the most triggering for me. It activates everything within me when I see her just yell out in anger and start punching the couch or throwing her dolls around, because my upbringing and my wounds, the first instinct is squash that. Tell her to stop because you have to be good no matter how you feel. Whereas when I say take responsibility, it's to recognize I have an opportunity in that moment to give her the safest of safe places to express that and to teach her, oh my God, how to take deep breaths, how, what she can and can't hit. Like, it's okay. You can go hit that wall, to let her scream her lungs out, to let her cry for as long as she wants to cry without feeling like, okay, that's all the crying I can take. It's my responsibility to decide in that moment that I'm going to let her let out her emotions safely rather than making it feel personal to me, like, how dare you? Because I wasn't allowed to do that. And in doing so, it just heals something in me a little bit more. And you don't need to call a therapist in that moment to take responsibility for that. It's hard to do. And sure. I'm not saying any of this is easy, but I am saying whether in little moments I fail or I learn, or in other moments, like I heal a little bit because I move through it in a different way than I did in the past. Those are, it's just moment to moment taking responsibility. And sometimes it's just taking, like going, I've apologized to my little girl so many times. I can't even count.
Yeah.
Because I'm teaching that. I was like, I want them to know what it's like to have a mom who apologizes and takes responsibility
and
for.
And sometimes I react.
Up. Yeah.
You know, and I have to come back to you and say, hey, I'm sorry that I reacted that way. I'm going to tell you what was going through my mind. And, but I also want you to know that I'm going to really try not to do that again.
Yeah.
But not in a, I didn't really, I might have just lost my temper and said, put that down or whatever.
Yeah.
But, oh, hey, I'm sorry. But you know what? And I might have told you this at some point, but I remember when my daughter and my son are totally different too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's normal, right? My son is Mr. I just want to be funny. And it doesn't matter what he does. At the end of the day, he'll be like, oh, what was it, funny, mom? And so he's goofy, happy, just smart. And then I have my daughter who's like introspective, has anxiety, gets pissed, and just all of that. Mm-hmm. But I remember when they were younger, I had this, my husband had put in my car a little screen and we would watch, I could put in like the movie Inside Out. And so we would watch that movie and we would just see it in little chunks a lot of the time, but it ended up staying in my car literally for a year. But have you seen that movie Inside Out?
So good. I'm trying. My girls aren't quite there. I try to turn it on. They're like,
yeah. Oh my gosh. So I think my son was a little bit older and my daughter was about two. And so he would be watching it. Eventually we watched it so often that they just got it. I swear every time I got something from that little movie because it's all about the emotions.
It's so good.
And how they intertwine with one another. And I remember my son saying, oh, mom, anger is really getting a hold of Scarlett right now. And it would make me laugh. And then he would use little things from that movie to try to pull her and give her tools to get out of it. And I was like, this movie is brilliant. Everybody should watch it.
It is.
But I personally would learn so much from watching it. I just saw that Inside Out 2 is coming out. I'm really excited.
Oh.
Because I think it's about puberty. And of course, that's where my kids are headed. So it was definitely made for that, my generation of, because it's perfect timing for them. But anyway.
That's so cool to see. I feel the same way. I have no greater joy than when I see my girls. Like I've taught my youngest, my oldest hasn't really taken it up, but my youngest tapping, EFT works so well for her. And so I love to see her
awareness.
I'll start tapping her and it just soothes her body and just getting in her body because she's so physical. Like
and that breath. What an important thing to teach. I don't know. I'm sure we were taught it so often, but it is not utilized enough to just take a moment, take three deep breaths. Man, sometimes if I have to get with my children and do that, it's like helping me just as much as it's helping them.
Yeah, well, because we think everything has to happen in here, in our mind. We think, okay, I have this thought. That's not true. Feelings aren't facts. I'm not really a piece of shit. I'm actually pretty great. We think it all has to happen as a conversation in our mind, or I do. I like to intellectualize everything.
Yeah, but your brain needs that oxygen.
How is taking some deep breaths and tapping, or how is that really going to work? And it's because very little of changing these messages, really very little of it happens cognitively. A lot of it is in our bodies. So much of it is in our bodies. And so I can't really explain step by step how breathing and releasing and letting go in the moment works and why it works.
Do you meditate?
I just know that it does. No, I don't. I don't really. But I do a lot of, I'll have to give you her handle so you can link it. But there's a woman named Valentina Bain, and she is the best in somatic experiencing overall, but she has some really practical, because I like to get practical too. I'm like, tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And so
give me
she
tools.
Has like really practical, and I'm talking like really simple things you can do in the car that don't take a lot of time, but also like more meditative practices too. I found my favorites that work into the busy working mom schedule that I really like, but it's such a joy to see my girls. They've started defending each other, by the way. If I start to get onto one of them and they've started like defending each other to me, which I love because they'll tell me, they'll hold me accountable because they've learned these concepts of, I feel, this is the way I feel. But they'll tell me, mommy, are you going to say you're sorry for raising your voice? And I love that because I do mess up. I yell sometimes. I ignore them sometimes because I'm distracted.
Yeah.
Or I shame them sometimes without intending to. And so what's really important for me is rather than sinking into the shame of that as a mom, is to practice going back and having a conversation about it at an age appropriate level and letting them know that wasn't okay. And that actually was not your fault.
I've caught myself doing that with my daughter, not necessarily with my son, but my daughter is so much more like me and harder to deal with in that situation. Cause I'm like, I should be really well equipped to be able to deal with you because you're just like me. And I know that look and I know what you're thinking.
Yep.
But that's actually when I'm not good at helping her because she does not have the tools that I now have yet. And so I have to take myself back for a second and try to say, hey, I know that feeling. I have it too. I had that when I was your age, or this is when I had it. Mm-hmm. These are some of the things I did. But typically I have to come back and apologize first to say, hey, I'm sorry that I reacted that way. I know you have it in you. And so I need to help you find that, not force it.
Yeah.
And that's really hard. Anyway, going back to, let's go back to your family though, because I know that you are doing so much work to, in your way, right the wrongs, and you're trying to stop that, as we call it, generational trauma. You're trying to stop it and trying to say, nope, I recognize it and I'm not going to let it move forward. And you're doing that with your girls. And I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
And I think that they will be so very thankful for it. And by the way, we're still going to screw them up.
Oh, absolutely. And as humans, it's so natural. Right. I was having this conversation the other day about more about finances and growing up poor and things like that. And somebody who was worried about, oh, I grew up in Section 8 housing and my kids have everything. They're not going to struggle. And I'm like, oh, they're going to struggle.
It's just going to look a little different.
It's human nature to find yeah. a way to struggle. My question is, do my girls always know that they can talk to me, that they are safe here, that they can always come home, that I will always be in their corner to help them? That's what's important, because they're going to struggle.
Yeah.
And I let them fall. I let them fall. They'll be climbing on a chair the wrong way and everybody's, oh, don't let them crawl. I'm like, this is a safe way to fall. They got to learn that they're going to trip sometimes on the stairs if they're not careful, that they're going to fall off that chair if they're messing around.
Yeah.
Like they have to learn.
Like I said, you can tell them. I can tell my children, don't touch that fire. They're really going to learn it when they do.
Yes. And all I wanted to do as a child was to do the thing, all of the things that I was being told not to do, and just keeping it in my inside as a secret. But with my family as part of that, I know I said that my perspective when I first started trying to get sober is different than it is now. And what mm-hmm. I really mean by that is back then I was so angry. Is when I finally, which I think is an okay, necessary part of healing, by the way,
we must actually allow people to feel anger.
You have to. It was the most, I learned very quickly, it was the most off-limits emotion growing up. I carried that through adulthood and I swallowed so much anger that when it finally started coming out, it was like this volcanic, to the point where I was scared and I was like, when does this end? Like, I feel so much rage anytime that I let myself feel it and express it. And some of the ways that I expressed it were very unhealthy. And I'd say I regret it, but it's more just, it's part of my journey. I would get drunk and lash out at my parents. I ended up cutting them off altogether at that time and doing it not in a conscious way, but doing it in a drunken, I am like a rageaholic right now. I hate you. I never want to hear from you again. Do that sort of way, telling them to go fuck off, basically. Mm-hmm. And you were the worst parents that have ever existed on the face of the earth. I very much blamed them. So at the time, which was a necessary part of me coming to terms with this and processing this, but it looked very ugly because I really assigned blame. I blamed them for everything that had ever happened to me, which of course isn't the case. I'm also an autonomous human being who made some decisions. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But that's what it looked like. So I cut them off for a time, didn't speak to them for a while, actually until I had my second baby. And around that time, my mom had tried to make contact a few times and I was in a good enough place. And I really, a lot evolved inside of me since then, but I didn't feel like it was appropriate or necessary for me to necessarily go back and apologize and go, I'm sorry, that's the way I cut it off. But I still don't want to talk to you. So I didn't have a conversation with them. And I had this like inner feeling that it would come at some point, but I really just focused on having my kids, learning how to be a mom. I'm in recovery. I'm sober. I'm healing, all of these things, really coming into my own. And then the timing just felt right for me to reengage first with my mom. And I started to do that. And it ended up that she came in town after my second baby was born and stayed for about a week. She came with my dad. I had reconnected with my aunt at this time, mind you. Then when it was this whole complicated web, when she found out that I had reengaged with my parents and I told her that, she no longer felt safe in a relationship with
sure.
me, which is completely understandable. But I always, throughout that time, I was like, I need to stop worrying about everybody else and how everybody else is going to react, you know,
yeah.
to my decisions.
You need to do your own healing.
Do my own, do what feels right for me and my family, especially me and my girls. That's what it's yeah. about. And So I really cultivated and naively thought that cultivating this relationship, me and my parents talked about a bunch of things, a lot of things from the past. They, to the best of their ability, Corrine, they, to the best of their ability, took responsibility for some things and apologized for some things. And I say to the best of their ability because it's still very difficult for my parents to not make it about them. But I was really so grateful for how things were unfolding. And I naively thought, we've reconciled and we're going to be a happy family now, not realizing that sickness still exists and everybody's got to do their own work.
Yes.
And we all reconnected and I just started to get really started to feel emotionally like I was going through the same circus. So when I got better, suddenly my parents fell apart and they don't live together. My mom's off doing whatever she's doing. My dad went to a mental hospital and got diagnosed with borderline personality disorder and just all of their life just became a total shit show. And because they no longer have the sick one in the family. And
so, or you were just able to see it.
Yeah, but it's allowed, I think they really bonded. My brother and I have talked about this because he and I have bonded even closer through this experience, which is the silver lining in all of this, right? But we've talked about how I think my parents really, they share a trauma bond. And the narcissist borderline personality disorder relationship is a particular like combo. It's a strong, not a healthy bond, but it's a strong bond. And I think they really bonded over having a sick shit show of a child. And so when that was no longer there, they were just left with what? That's just been crazy. And I honestly don't really know what's going on in their lives right now, happily, because I just started recognizing, I was like, I'm taking on all their stuff. I'm falling into the same patterns where my mom calls pretending, like she's calling to FaceTime my girls, but really she's unloading. Doing that thing where she's pretending to try not to cry because she's waiting for the opportunity for me to steal off into the next room and ignore my girls and give her a couple hours of attention to talk her through something, knowing she's not going to take my advice, but believing she is in the moment and then remembering later, oh, she didn't want my advice. She wanted my attention. And so I was getting sucked back into those kind of same patterns, I always heard about way more like inappropriate things with my mom that I should have never heard about as a kid. She was still telling me like all of these things about her life that I was just like, I don't actually want to know this stuff. And so I started telling her, I was like, I don't want to hear anything else about X. I don't want to hear anything else. And then I made the decision to just cut my dad out of my life completely. And that was 100% because it had nothing to do with my aunt, actually. It was just, I had tried to make that work and I just felt really uneasy. And I reached the point, my girls were still like one to two, maybe younger than that. But I was like, it was very early on. And I was like, I would rather explain to them someday why they couldn't have a relationship with him than why, knowing what I know, I allowed it. And I just didn't want him to be a part of my girl's life. I didn't feel good about it. And I let that go. And I lovingly expressed that to him, that I love you and I forgive you and I do not want you to suffer. But this is the decision I've come to that I feel is right for my family. And I have felt, that was a year and a half, 2 years ago. I've felt that peace about it ever since.
What was his reaction during that time?
His reaction was actually really understanding. He has a certain disorder that makes him pretty volatile. So he can go, and I've watched it happen so many times, especially with my brother. He takes it out more on my brother than me. He's gentler with me. My mom, it's in reverse. But he reacted so well in the moment. And he actually said the words, I'm sorry I put you in this position. Now, my mom was there and she chimed in to let me know, oh, this is why I have to be there for your dad. Because did you know he was suicidal just a few months ago? And I'm worried this is going to make him suicidal again. And I looked at her and I said, you better stop talking right now if you ever want to see your grandchildren again or something to that effect. Because I was like, oh, my dad's reacting great. But my mom, of course, took it as an opportunity to make it about them and suggest that my boundaries might be responsible for my dad's suicide. And I was like, this conversation is not going to go any further. We're done here. So things ended on good terms between me and my dad. And the weird irony is I have not done that same thing with my mom. However, because after that, the way I can best describe it is I was like, I can't find a relationship with her small enough to not suck the ever living life out of me. And it was pointed out to me at one point, do you realize every single time that your mom visits or you see her, you get sick physically? You get sick, you get low emotionally, and you just have your energy zapped. And I had to really recognize that and spend some time doing some specific work around just mother wounds, because I was like, this is sucking the energy out of me. And I feel such a sense of obligation for some reason to maintain ties with my mom. And so where we're at now and where I landed was, she and I really, we don't have an emotional relationship. We don't have a bond, but we'll always have a bond, of course. She's my mother and I love her. And I want to see the best things happen for her. I want that with both my parents. But I, beyond being the conduit for her to talk to my girls, there's nothing between her and I, as far as like, I don't have any expectations of her.
Sure.
I don't use her as support or encouragement or a sounding board like other people may use their mom. And like, my mom probably wants to be. So I'm not saying my mom doesn't want those things, or that she's not trying to
be. But you don't know how to have that relationship because you've never had it. Do you see, so since she's involved in your girls' lives, have you seen any, I mean, they're pretty young still. I don't think they would understand it anyway, but do you monitor those calls just to make sure that there's no...
Oh, I monitor everything.
Yeah. Just to make sure that they aren't feeling a certain way or using them to get to you or...
I do, but I also try to take the mental pressure off of myself to manage it.
Yeah.
But I do, I stay around and I only accept calls or call her on the rare occasion that I feel like it. You know what I mean? If it feels like a burden or I feel like that tense, oh, I got to answer. I'm like, oh, I need to not answer right now. That's what I need to do. But it's interesting you ask that question, because seeing her interact with my girls, not because of their interaction, but because of the way I was feeling about it, is what prompted me to do a mother wound healing class. I'm going to send you another account to tag in like the show notes.
Okay.
Wonderful. Because Laura Lee Pajas, she's actually a colleague of Mega, did some training with her and she does very similar healing work, but her specialization is all focused on mother wounds. So specifically like mother-daughter dynamics, whether you had a great relationship with your mom or a terrible one, like those mother wounds that we all carry, or many of us do. But what prompted it was watching, there was one visit in particular where I was watching them. And Joelle, like I said, my oldest daughter is like me and she's like an entertainer and a people pleaser and she wants everybody to be happy. And that's how she gauges things, is like by, are the people around her happy? She just wants everybody to be happy. My younger one doesn't give a fuck. She gauges things by, what do I want and what do I need? And so she has no problem being honest. And
I saw that recently when we went to a friend's outdoor kind of get together for their business. And your daughters were, they were both wanting Hershey Kisses.
Huh? Yeah. Which they never have.
And your oldest was like, I don't know if that's, can I have one? No. And was like looking around to see if it was okay. And your youngest is like, I need that now. And I'm, is anybody paying attention to me? Because I need that.
Yeah. Like, I want chocolate. She has like a husky voice. And I want chocolate. You ask her if she did. Did you rip all those books up? I did. I ripped the books. Like, she's not even sorry. She's the best. She's a little thing of her own. But I was watching her. My older one is trying to love on my mom and show her toys and interact with her. And my youngest one is literally coming up to me and she's, I don't like granny. I want granny go bye-bye. And I was mortified and like embarrassed.
You're like, oh my gosh.
But I noticed that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That I was like, I was more concerned watching them play with how my mom was feeling than how my girls were feeling. And I noticed that feeling in me and I was like, what is that? Why? I love them more than anything in this world, but something in me is more concerned about how my mom feels right now. And are they giving her enough validation?
Sure.
When it should be all about my girls.
And maybe it's because you know that you're not giving your mom the validation anymore. So somehow you feel like, oh, okay, at least
that's
she'll get it there.
But that's the point.
Yep.
Is then we pass along the role.
Yep.
If it's not healed in us, we're passing it along. Like I cry thinking about it. And I'm so thankful for that moment because it gave me that realization that I was like, oh, whether I want to or not, like there's still some stuff there that I really need to get real about with my feelings and my hurt with my mom. And so I went on this kind of whole journey with Laura Lee of just learning more about that and coming to terms with these old beliefs I have around my obligation to my mom and what any little girl's obligation is to their mom. And I can honestly say today, not that I'm all better or that all of that stuff healed. It's going to be a process.
Yeah.
But I can honestly say today, I don't believe children owe their parents anything. They didn't choose to come into this world. You do have an obligation to your kids. I owe my kids everything.
Man, because you did bring them into this world.
I brought them in and I'm the parent. I'm the mom for their whole lives. They owe me nothing. And that's such, I think that's where a lot of the misconception comes in, quite honestly, around family estrangement. First of all, it's a little bit of a generational thing where you're like, oh, you just tantrum throwing millennials who are so ungrateful. And I would never do that to my parents. And if my kids ever did that to me, I'd just die. And it's just a lack of understanding of, first of all, there's so much you don't know. And when you're judging people, oftentimes it's a bunch of women, moms or not moms, who are just trying to protect their energy so that they can create something safer and healthier and better for their family and for generations going forward. I view people who are experiencing any degree of estrangement as cycle breakers. That's how I view them. And I'm sure sometimes it looks messy, just like it has for me. And sometimes it doesn't mean that the person choosing those boundaries, the child choosing those boundaries, is blameless. I know I'm not, but it does mean they're trying to heal something. Let them, support them, encourage them. Watch like how God just provides these magical, nothing can replace a parent, but God has really provided for me in really surprising ways, relationships that really make me feel nurtured.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest thing that I've been working on recently, and like in the last 6 months, is nurturing myself and learning how to get my needs met and learning, by the way, that what I always thought were wants are really my needs. Because I think there are socially acceptable needs. Like, I need to work out. We're allowed to say that.
Sure.
Like that we need to exercise. Yeah. But we're not allowed to say, I need to get a massage, or I need to go get my nails done, or I need
to go take an infrared sauna.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so really owning, I actually practice right now. One of the cool things I do is I practice doing things that benefit nobody but me. Actually, like with intention.
That is really hard.
It's really hard, but doing something and on purpose, because I know that a little bit of shame is going to come into the equation. I do it so that I can practice. Okay. Like, I felt a little shame, but I didn't die. I breathed and I released and I let it go. Because every time I breathe and release and let that go, it gets a little easier and you start to feel worthy more often than you feel unworthy.
Yeah, that is actually what this is for me. And it's interesting because when I was talking to my kids about coming, I'd be like, well, I got to go in the morning. And I'm like, I'll be back before you guys are even like, maybe had breakfast. But also, it wasn't like, oh, I have to go do this so that I can share this out with the world so that we can help everybody. And it was, hey, I really need this for me because I need to sit down and listen to people and connect with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I need that for myself. And they're like, okay.
Yeah.
If you teach them that it's okay to do that. And then I think the hardest thing for me, and I know as my kids get older, to remember that they too will have some of those things and that I need to not take them personally when they do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's I know that's going to be a hard thing for me as I go along.
And I don't know if you feel like this, but I feel like one of the things I think about, not often, but one of the most important things I think about as a mom is, what kind of life do I want my girls to lead? Whatever life they want, whatever is their intended purpose, however they're wired, whatever they're meant to bring to this world, I want them to go live it. And it's a really hard realization as a mom, whether you have really young ones or teenage ones, it doesn't matter how old they are. It is tough to realize, oh, if I want my girls to believe that they can create whatever life they want, I have to model that myself.
Yeah.
And that's a heavy weight. And I'm still reconciling that right now because I'm realizing, like, for a long time, I didn't even know what I wanted. And so much of my day-to-day is, of course, nurturing and protecting and caring for them and just experiencing joy and ups and downs with them, but also taking moments to myself to go, now that I am more in touch with what I want, how do I go for it?
the hardest thing about being a mom, and how I have had friends who, as they became mothers, they wanted to be stay-at-home moms. They wanted to homeschool. They wanted to, they really wanted to provide the best life for their children as they thought was possible. Totally fine. All those decisions, there's nothing wrong with any one of those decisions. The one thing that I would constantly say is just don't forget who you are. Because if you forget who you are, they don't have a guiding light to say, what's that all for? I think that's the hardest thing, is to say, okay, you know what? And that's, again, this. I've wanted to do this. If I say that you should do what you want to do, then you need to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
To an extent. Obviously, I understand if I choose something over my children, there could potentially be a consequence. So I have to weigh that myself. And I need to decide, is that worth the decision that I've made? If I do think in the end that it's worth the decision because I get both of those things, great.
Oh, you're nailing it right now, because listen, I go overboard with my girls, but I recognize it's about me in those moments. Mm-hmm. I just took them to American Girl the other day, because when I have a big success, the first way I want to celebrate is I want to either experience something with them. I want to spend it on my girls.
Yeah.
I want to celebrate with them. But I recognize in that moment, I'm like, this is about me. I couldn't have this. So I want them to be able to have it. I am taking so much joy and healing and being able to say yes and not telling my kids, oh, it's too expensive, or trying to explain money to toddlers. Like, I can just say yes. No would be okay too, but I'm going to say yes for me. Mm-hmm. But I recognize that it's about me, because, and this is such an easy trap I feel like I fall into as a mom, is almost like wanting your kids to see you as someone who bent over backwards for them and sacrificed and laid down her life. And it's in some meme probably, but can you really live for your kids? Like, of course we'd die for them. We'd sacrifice. We'd bend over backwards whenever we have to. But can you also go live your life? Can you live and model it? Because you can tell them all day long, you can do anything you want, but if you're not doing it, they're looking at you. And if you're doing what you want to be doing, great. If you're taking care of yourself and your needs are getting met, wonderful. But if I don't want my kids to view me as some martyr when they grow up, and feel like that's the role that they have to then step into with their kids, if they have kids. But I don't want them to see me as a martyr. I want them to see me as their biggest initiator and cheerleader and encourager and support and nurturer, and know that, like, mom's got mom.
Yeah.
Mom's happy. I don't have to be a mirror image of her. All of the generations of girls in my family have felt like they've had to be mirror images of their mom.
Yeah. To pull this back around, what this conversation just made me realize, actually, is that my dad has an estranged sister. My mom had an estranged sister as well. And I, family in our little core unit is very important. It's like, blood is thicker than water, that whole. Mm-hmm. And I love my brothers. I love my parents. Family really is. And that was part of the thing that brought my husband and I together, because he had a very similar relationship with his family and this huge family. But I never understood. Okay, you're saying that blood is thicker than water, but you have an estranged sister. What is that?
Yeah.
But what I realized just in this moment is that we never had conversations specifically where we sat down and said, let's talk about boundaries. Mm. It was like this, you have to know your limits. It was probably taught through sports or through school or something where we learned it, but it was never like a conversation where we sat down. But what I realized just now is my parents emulated the boundaries. My dad had a boundary. He did a lot. He did a lot for his sister growing up. She had polio, so he was always her protector. And she eventually lost her leg and had a prosthetic. And she had, not to go into all that, but she had been married 5 times. She had some abusive relationships, and then her children and lots of stuff there. Mm. And at some point, I remember my oldest cousin, my dad was like, okay, we're going to help. He needs guidance. I'm going to straighten him out, basically. I'm going to come to my sister's rescue again because I'm a provider. When that all failed, he and his brother both tried. And when that failed, my dad was like, I'm done. Yeah, I had 2 sisters. That's what he would say. She's still alive. And he'd be like, I had 2 sisters. Or I only have one sister. I would be like, this is messed up. But I also understood why he did that. But I didn't fully understand that he was just showing me, hey,
how to enable someone. Yeah,
yeah. I've set a boundary. This is no longer going to affect my life or my kids' lives or anybody in my life because this affected us.
Yeah.
And he did that. And my mom the same way. Hers was, now, I will say this about my mom and her estrangement with her sister. This was something really beautiful. She did not talk to her sister. She felt like her sister was only a taker from her mother and lived close by and didn't give back. And so my mom was like, you know what? I'm done. She's not going to be invited to your wedding. This was 15 years ago. I was like, oh, okay. Well, she was my aunt and
yeah.
I have this cousin, but I respected that. This is her boundary. I get it. She's still upset about her mom and it is what it is. However, my aunt died 2 years ago and she had she had melanoblastoma. And when she was sick, she had no one. Mm. Her husband was also sick. They were actually in the same home because she was taking care of him. So when she ended up falling and getting admitted, he was in the same place and they didn't want him to know that she was down the hall because she was just taking care of him all the time. My mom showed up for her all the time.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, she was like, I couldn't, this can make me sad, just cry because my mom said I couldn't let her die alone. And that to me was what blood is thicker than water meant.
Yeah.
In that moment. Because I thought, oh, okay. It's totally okay for you to set that boundary, mom. For you to not have this person in your life that you didn't feel was respecting everything that was given to her. But I also see that you didn't want her to be alone. That was, in a way, a responsibility. A family. It just was beautiful.
It's so beautiful. You're going to make me cry because it's such a beautiful picture to me of the fact that love and boundaries do coexist, that they're not mutually exclusive. And I've been on the receiving end, by the way, of harsh boundaries like that. My little brother, when I had dragged him through the emotional ringer and he had just gotten married. He was working on his PhD. And here I am, like completely selfish and miserable and everything's about me and this tiny little depressed world I live in. And I was just constantly venting to him, pulling him into conversations with my parents where I'm yelling at them and just calling him when I'm drunk. And he had to detach. And as painful as it was at the time, I've always really respected him for that because he reached a point where he said, I've got a family that I'm starting. I am working on my PhD. This is too much for me right now. I can't have this in my life. And I love you, but like you're out. And he and I didn't speak until around the time that I started speaking again with my parents. So a good year and a half or so. And that was incredibly painful for me. But at first we would try to, but then I couldn't stay sober. And so we went a long gap without speaking because he set that boundary. And then because I started healing enough to learn how to respect that boundary. And so, for example, when I first got sober, finally, I didn't immediately rush to call my brother. I was like, he deserves to see this stick.
Oh, this
he deserves is real. To have a little bit of time to know, for me to know and for him to know, is this real? And is she working on herself? And is she actually going to be a good sister to me again? And I say again, because I was a hell of a sister to him until I wasn't. And I have always like really, there's never been a point where, now they did at some point, we had a conversation about, they never apologized for the boundary because it was worth thanking them over. Because that's the most loving thing you can do for somebody who's sick, by the way, is set those boundaries and not enable them. If I had continued to have my brother to just vent to and to co-sign my bullshit, then who knows how long I would have struggled with that.
Right.
Because I thought like he was my go-to dumping ground.
His boundary actually potentially helped you have enough to say enough.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's, I love the fact that we did talk about boundaries and that they are okay. And that family estrangement is really hard. because you do, as you said before, it's, you feel like you aren't a good daughter, or you feel like you aren't a good sister, or, and that causes so much shame. However, those boundaries sometimes are the things that can lead to healing and can lead to, whether it's healing in that situation or with that relationship, or healing of yourself in order to potentially come back to it or not, if that's what's necessary.
Yeah.
And as hard as it seems, no one wants to be estranged from their family.
No.
But I do think it's important to understand that sometimes it's a must.
Yeah, sometimes it's a must. And we have no idea. I don't know nearly enough about God and this universe to know how everything works and is tied together. But I do, I feel like at the end of the day, we have to trust our gut. And so much of healing for me has been clearing away the stuff that was stifling what I believe we all have in us, with just an inner intuition, Holy Spirit, capital K, knowing, that instinct. I think we all have that like helpful instinct in us, but sometimes it's just covered by so many layers of guilt and shame and grief and regret and anger that we're operating from those emotions mm-hmm. instead of from our gut instinct. And so a lot of healing has been like really getting in touch for the first time with that gut instinct about what's right for me. And I'm not talking morally right. I'm talking what is the next right thing for me. And it's so hard to honor that sometimes, because sometimes the right thing is to cut someone out of your life.
Yeah.
And you have to trust and know, I don't know why that is, because it seems harsh. I feel guilty for it, but can I take responsibility for that guilt? Can I breathe, release, and let it go? Can I handle that myself, not make anybody else responsible for it, and let them go and just trust? Who knows what God has in store? Maybe he wanted you to detach so that it would give them a wake-up call to go heal. Maybe he wanted you to detach because he has someone else who needs to fulfill a role, and they need to feel that need before that other person can come in and fill it. You have no idea.
I think we forget about humanity. What is humanity, and why do we have it, and what's the interconnection and the energy and all of that stuff? We get so caught up in the rules and regulations of social living that we forget at the very core, anthropologically, what we needed from each other and for ourselves.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed this. And I was thinking really hard. I am not going to cry. I cried.
Of course I did. I only teared up, so I win.
Okay, I'll give it to you.
I'll cry in the car later. Yeah. That's fine.
We cry enough. And it's okay. Again, feeling anger and feeling like I do. And you saw, this is exactly how I cry. They just mm-hmm. fall down my face. Very seldom do I have the ugly cry. And then you know, something's deep.
I had one the other night, and I was like, afterwards, I was like, oh, wow, I needed that.
Yeah,
it's okay. It's such a physical release. Yes. All those stress chemicals. Sometimes you need a good ugly cry.
Yeah, and just putting an emotional and a feeling to it in words and love mm-hmm. it, acknowledging it and giving it the space.
Yes.
I think it's great. I have a little part at the end of these that I always do, and that is tell me give me one example in the last week that you did not feel good enough.
Oh, I forgot that was going to be a question. Oh, but I already know what it is. Yeah, it was, I took my girls to American Girl, and it was this moment where we were in the mall. We were there to get their face painted, but the face painting station was closed. And now I'm going to cry after I was bragging about not crying.
Yes.
My older one, Joelle, she saw a little girl with a doll. And she said, Mommy, can I have one of those dolls? And I just had this moment where I paused and I was like, oh, this sounds so stupid. See, right now I'm not feeling good enough. My story's good enough. But I had one of those moments where I was like, no would be a fine answer. I could say no, because I do tend to dote on them a lot. And I'm trying to balance that with teaching them, like, no, we can't get new things every day because we want to give you an opportunity to enjoy the things you have already. And I never want to impress upon them it's because it's too expensive, or give them any sort of message that they're a burden for asking for things. I want them to ask for what they want. even though it can get crazy. But she asked, and I know, like, I'm not walking out of that store without spending $500. That's why I've never taken them there. And they've never been really old enough to enjoy it anyway. But now she wants this doll. And I looked at her, and for me, I said yes. And we went, and it was a whole thing. And they were so excited, and they had so much joy, and were just like talking with their dolls, playing with their doll, like just having the time of their life. Their dolls were going to marry each other. Like, they had a whole life plan set out for their dolls. And it gave me so much joy. And the way it was received by other people in my family was not so great. Like, oh, I'll leave. Because I'm texting people, and through no fault of their own, it's fine. But they were responding with, what? You've just opened a can of worms. Get ready. Now they're going to want, you're going to spend thousands of dollars, and they're going to want to go there and blah, blah, blah. And how much did that cost? And just immediately raining on the parade unintentionally. But the way I internalized that is it just sucked the joy right out for me. And I chose, I was like, I'm going to stay in this moment of joy with my girls, regardless of what other people are saying or how I'm feeling. I'm going to stay in this moment. And it was after they finally went to bed with their dolls that I just sat down and I realized, like, other people's reactions started, just subtle reactions. Suddenly, everything rushed back to me that I cannot be responsible, that I am a burden, that I'm going to send my family to the poorhouse. Those were the messages that I received when I was younger. It's like, we can't afford it, and we're like scared about money constantly. And you even asking for something or having a want is so cruel and so wrong and so bad, because it makes us feel burdened. I just always believed I was such a burden. I've had my mom literally line item as an adult what she spent on piano lessons and da, da, da. I just went through old receipts and I spent this and this and this because you wanted to do all of those things, because you just had to do all of those things. So all of that came rushing back, and I just felt really low. And I was like, I just went and did this for me. I didn't do it for them. I did it for me. And then I had a good ugly cry, and I was like, you know what? That's okay. Sometimes it's okay to do things for me too.
Yeah.
And did I just set a dangerous precedent with my girls? Probably. I probably did.
But now you can also say no. Oh, no, you have it. We have one that was given to us for holidays, and we have a limit sometimes.
Oh, like, and that's already happened multiple times since then, by the way. Don't worry about it. It's already out. They're like, well, can we go to the mall? I'm like, the mall burned down. The mall's closed. We can't go to the mall. Not until your birthday. We can't go to the mall. But I really didn't. I felt like a child again in that moment. And it was all from the silliest thing.
It's because questioning your decision.
Bought some dolls. Yeah, just really questioning myself. And why did I do that? And was it the right thing to do? When at the end of the day, it's, that's what I wanted to do in the moment. What's wrong with that? Nothing.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong
with
that.
Didn't hurt anybody.
No.
And maybe your pocketbook a little.
But it's just, I have it.
Yeah.
I have it. I get to decide how to spend it. I don't care what the world thinks is worthy of my money and isn't. It's my money. And it's my decision. And I just have to learn, but it's so hard for me, right? Because my bellwether for my gauge of how I'm doing in life has always been gauged by other people and what they think about it.
Yeah.
And so it was really challenging me in that moment to go, can I just own my decisions and not feel like a piece of shit just because I spent too much money on some dolls?
Yeah. Let's see. So mine is actually very simple. Somebody asked me if I would speak or do something at an event coming up. And my initial response was fear. I don't typically have a hard time speaking in front of somebody, but was fear. And my very first response to her was, oh, I can think of a lot of people who do a better job than me. Instead of saying, thank you for having that faith. And she even said to me right after that, we really want to have somebody in the community. We're going to have a male and a female in the community. And you were the one I chose. And I was like, oh, no, I just couldn't even. And there's a lot more behind it. I won't go into it right now, but it was just my initial was like, and then I felt, oh, I'm on the spot. And what do I have to say? And I just had this moment of anxiety, which is so weird because most of the time I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll do it. Whatever.
Yeah.
It'll be great. I'll wing it. But I just had this moment where I am not the right person for that. And I think there is validity in that, actually, because I can think of people that could do a much better job for this particular thing. But I am also appreciative that I was thought of and I had to accept that. Anyway, the last little part is tell me your glimmer. What is your glimmer from the week?
The same story, Corinne.
Wonderful.
Same
thing. I do that often too, where it's the same story.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, because you were able to.
Yeah, and I got through it.
Yeah.
And accepted, at the end, accepted myself and my decisions and healed I know that I healed something just a little bit more that needed it.
Yeah.
So I was really thankful for that opportunity to go through it a little bit, have a good ugly cry, and get the opportunity to just heal something a little bit more. And also being on this podcast. Although, like, when you first asked me, I was like, I don't know if I feel good enough of the time to be good enough for the Good Enough Woman podcast.
I know. Honestly, I think that's how every single person responds. Mm-hmm. Because again, we don't give ourselves enough credit. My glimmer is actually from last night. We were playing Go Fish. Very simple game.
Oh boy.
But my son kept winning. Gosh, he just won every time. But the last game that we played, we did three games. He won. And then my husband was like, no, we're continuing to go. Because he just kept winning like right away. So then I'm like, okay. Then I was out. I'm like, okay, no, you guys keep going. Because my daughter was just like beside herself that she hadn't won yet. And so they're playing and it went on for a long time. They got through the entire deck and we used sequence cards. You know how many games are in, how many cards are in a sequence deck?
Oh, yeah.
Anyway. So they're going,
I know my card games.
Yeah. So they're going, and we were listening to an album of a friend of ours and she had released it yesterday. So we're like in the background music. It was cool. And then I was like, oh, I'm going to take a little video of them asking because it would be like they'd be down to one card. And so they had no choice but to ask for the same thing every time. And it just started getting funny.
Yeah.
And then they'd pick one up and they'd get the card they asked it. And so I just was filming it. And in the middle, and my son's over there between them going, oh, ah, he's making all these sounds. Cause again,
right.
He wants to be funny.
Yeah.
And so we all were laughing. And then all of a sudden he just let out the biggest fart.
Oh, this is fart humor. Okay.
But it was on video and his face was just like, and for those of you that can't see my face, it was just this like bright eyed. And then everybody in the room started laughing. And I immediately was like, I'm sending that to the family text. And I loved that moment because I remember so many times as a child I love games, just playing games, having the fun.
Yeah.
There was nothing else. We needed to go to bed, but we were playing Go Fish, super simple game, just having a good time. Everybody in the room started laughing. And then that's how we went to bed. Oh. And it was sweet. So that was my glimmer, is just having a moment together of innocence.
Yes.
Go Fish is probably the most innocent card game you can play.
That's super sweet. Your glimmer was a fart.
A fart. Loved it.
I thought I'd be immune to that as a girl mom. And no, the fart humor is still very much alive.
It's great. Anyway, thank you so much for coming on here to share your story with us and not being afraid to talk about how important boundaries and being okay, having an estrangement as you go through your own journey. And I can't wait to find out as time goes where that evolves for you and how it looks later on.
I'm excited to find out too. Yeah, to be determined. Thank you for just opening up your space to
absolutely
bring this up. I was like, Green, I really want to talk about estrangement. It's just so on my heart. And so thank you for
And I have to tell you one last thing before I go. So while I was sitting, I already said this, but you're a beautiful woman, but you're hidden your nose below. And as you're talking to me, I'm like, I got it. You look like Heather Locklear.
Oh.
Am I?
Okay, I'll take it. That's not the first time I've heard that one.
I didn't think you had. I didn't think that was the first time. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, beautiful, beautiful heart, beautiful soul. And I can't wait for everybody to hear about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Creed.
If you enjoyed today's episode, take a minute to jump over to www.thegoodenoughwoman.com, where you can connect with us on socials, find the latest episodes, leave a review, check out our merch, and most importantly, connect. And definitely let us know if you have a subject or a person you think is worth exploring. Again, thanks for listening and helping us all settle in our good enough.